The following episode is brought to you by the American Urological Association. This episode is a continuation of the AUA 2023 take-home messages presented live in Chicago.
Next will be take-home messages, infertility, andrology, Joshua Halpern from Northwestern University. Dr. Halpern.
Thank you, and thanks to the AUA for the opportunity to present the take-home messages for infertility. We really had an outstanding meeting with a lot of interesting and exciting research in this field. I have no relevant disclosures. One of the themes that really emerged was the impact of lifestyle and exposures on male fertility and sperm. This was a really nice study from Dr. Hedges and the group out of Oregon highlighting THC. So they wanted to understand how THC impacts sperm quality. They performed a whole genome sequencing study looking at rhesus monkeys at a number of different time points relevant to THC exposure: baseline, before exposure, during high THC exposure, and then importantly after exposure, to determine whether the changes that were seen with exposure were maintained or persisted after that time. And what they found is that there were a number of DNA methylation regions that were altered during the course of THC exposures that actually persisted even after cessation of use. And importantly, these differentially methylated regions mapped onto very important neurocognitive genes that are implicated in disorders such as autism spectrum disorders. A little bit of a red flag for the potential impact of THC on sperm quality, and look forward to more research from this group. In a similar vein, this was work from Dr. Peltzman and the group out of University of Pittsburgh looking at the effect of e-cigarettes on sperm quality and bulk semen parameters. They sought to use a mouse model to understand the impact of e-cigarettes on sperm concentration as well as sperm quality via apoptosis and DNA damage. And what they did was they compared the wild type control group to two different experimental groups. One was a vaping group where they did administer e-cigarette vape, but a second kind of pseudo control group where they administered only the vehicle but not the actual e-cigarette vapor. And interestingly, both of those groups saw a significant decline in their sperm concentrations both at 5 weeks and at 10 weeks of exposure. And similarly, when you look towards the tunnel testing, a measure of sperm DNA damage and apoptosis, you can again see that both the vehicle alone group and the vaping groups had some degree of alteration in their apoptotic patterns, again showing that these exposures are potentially deleterious to sperm. We need to do a better job furthering this research to try to understand how they might affect reproduction in the longer term. Varicocele is certainly always important for our patients given the high prevalence. There were a number of great studies on varicocele. This was one from the group out of Columbia trying to use decision analysis to give us a better understanding as to what the optimal approach might be to a couple with a male factor infertility relative or responsible by a varicocele. They used a Markov model approach, modeling different health states with inputs from the literature to try to understand what the best initial approach for that couple might be. Is it to fix the varicocele? Is it to send them to intrauterine insemination or possibly in vitro fertilization? And what they found is that if you do assume that fixing a varicocele increases the chance of achieving a pregnancy by about 5% or more, which I think is a very reasonable presumption based on the available data, that you do see improved pregnancy rates at lower costs in aggregate according to their model by fixing varicoceles first. About 75% of all couples would achieve a pregnancy in about 19 months at a cost of $34,000, which was the lowest of all these strategies. So, you know, maybe we need to be a little bit more aggressive in some cases about fixing varicoceles based on some of this data. There were a number of great presentations on fertility preservation. This was a study out of Memorial Sloan Kettering looking at fertility preservation in the setting of testicular cancer. They studied about 100 men who were undergoing radical orchiectomy and underwent semen analysis and banking prior to orchiectomy. And what they found was that the prevalence of semen parameter abnormalities was actually quite high, about 20% with severe oligospermia and about 15% with azoospermia. So an important reminder that we really should be sending these men to bank even if they're only having a radical orchiectomy, no necessary plans for chemotherapy, and a normal contralateral testis, still a reasonable chance of azoospermia. And they also performed a multivariable model to try to determine what were the predictors of being azoospermic, and really the only significant predictor was having a small testicle on the side of the tumor. a couple of great studies related to fertility preservation in the transgender space. This is data out of the UK looking at their series of over 100 patients who were presenting for fertility preservation prior to initiation of gender-affirming hormone therapy. They found that only about 65% of patients were able to produce a sample via masturbation and cryopreserved sperm. When they did, they have an average of about 6.5 vials stored, which is pretty good. But as with the testis cancer paper, there was a pretty high prevalence of semen parameter abnormalities. So about 12% of these patients were azoospermic and were offered testicular sperm extraction. The other potential option for some of these patients is testicular tissue cryopreservation, which is still experimental, but particularly important for young adolescent patients who have not yet reached spermarchy. And this is data from the Mayo Clinic detailing their series of 20 patients in that exact setting, median age of about 12 years. They deliver the testicle, take a wedge biopsy from the testicle, as you can see here, and attempt to isolate spermatogonial stem cells from that specimen for possible use down the road with future technologies. And they were successful in isolating spermatogonial stem cells in every single one of these patients. So certainly very encouraging about the potential downstream therapeutic impact of this work. There were a couple really nice papers looking at health policy, particularly vis-a-vis state mandates for fertility coverage. Dr. Sandozi and colleagues did a kind of simple but very elegant job in outlining the existing state fertility mandates, which is kind of a moving target because we see changes in this legislation on a regular basis. And Dr. Dupree and his group out of the University of Michigan took that one step further, try to understand what was the impact of these state fertility mandates on the actual utilization of IVF services as well as male fertility services. And they looked at three different groups. In the first group, they examined states that had mandates for both female and male fertility coverage. In the second group, looking at states that only have IVF mandates. And then the third group, looking at states with no mandates. And not surprisingly, what they found was that utilization was the highest in that first group for both IVF and male fertility procedures, things like varicocelectomies, testicular epididymal biopsy. Vasectomy reversal is, of course, an outlier because they tend not to be covered even under state insurance mandates. So again, good evidence that these mandates are useful. They are improving access to care, and I think we need to advocate for them in the states that don't yet have them. Non-obstructive azoospermia, certainly one of the most devastating conditions in our field, and a number of great papers looking at NOA. This came out of the University of Miami, trying to understand whether the microbiome plays a role in the pathogenesis of NOA. So they compared the seminal microbiome in men with NOA to those who were fertile controls. They actually found that all the men with NOA, they had kind of a less diverse microbiome, and they actually had a microbiome that was enriched for more known pathogens. So there does seem to be some level of dysbiosis that is implicated in the pathophysiology of NOA. Further work needs to be done, but this is certainly an encouraging line of inquiry. When it comes to surgical therapy, there were a number of groups that tried to identify ways that might predict the chance of significant sperm retrieval in the setting of a microtesi. A lot of novel approaches towards doing this. Jenkins et al. Looked at sperm-specific DNA methylation ratios to try to understand who might have sperm when undergoing microtesi. Kobayashi et al. Used an artificial neural network approach, kind of this AI model, to predict sperm retrieval. And lastly, Barney et al. Were looking at seminal cell-free DNA to try to discriminate between sperm and somatic DNA with ultimate implications in that same clinical setting. So still not great at predicting sperm retrieval, but there are some innovative approaches on the horizon. Lastly, but certainly not least, you know, male contraception has really eluded us as a field, and really exciting work coming out of Australia looking at a novel contraceptive approach. So Anderson et al. Studied a degradable hydrogel that is a form of non-hormonal contraception by way of occluding the vas deferens and preventing sperm transit. It utilizes a no-scalpel vasectomy approach to externalize the vas as you would with any vasectomy procedure, and this novel injector that you can see here to deliver the hydrogel and occlude the vas deferens. They performed an initial trial in just a few patients, but importantly, the safety profile appeared very good. There were a number of adverse events, but these were by and large mild and moderate. No severe adverse events were noted. And most of these adverse events were those that you would see after any vasectomy procedure, mild discomfort, bruising, and the like, all of which resolved within the first few days. Importantly, efficacy was quite good in this initial sample, so all of the participants achieved azoospermia within the first 30 days after the procedure. Very, very encouraging work in a space where we really haven't seen a lot of novel therapeutics. Certainly, we do need some longer-term data. We need to understand the degradation profile on the optimal patient, but this is really exciting for a space where we haven't seen a lot of traction. So really exciting time to be in our field, a lot of great research, and thank you again for the opportunity to summarize it.
Thank you very much. Our next presentation will be on the take-home messages concerning sexual dysfunction. Our speaker will be Peter Sambarlis, assistant professor from Rush University Medical Center.
Thank you. It's an absolute honor to present the take-home messages for sexual dysfunction in my hometown of Chicago, so thank you to the AUA. I have nothing to disclose. I have categorized the take-home messages, highlights of the AUA, into four categories: Peyronie's disease, penile prosthetics, pelvic floor physical therapy, and regenerative therapies. I'd like to start with the talk on Peyronie's disease in a study by Fang and colleagues, where they identified a potential novel therapeutic agent for PD. This was done possibly out of necessity, as collagenase is not available in Canada, but they found that actinidin, which can be extracted from kiwi, reduced cellular bound collagen in their human PD model. And this is a very exciting thing to look forward to in the future as maybe another therapeutic agent in a space with very few. There was a lot of presentations on collagenase and its utility, but one I wanted to highlight was the use of collagenase in atypical presentations of Peyronie's disease. These are the conditions that were typically excluded from the IMPRESS trials, and what they found was safety and efficacy in men with hourglass deformities, ventral curves, multiplanar curves, or calcified plaques, and that the change in curvature with therapy was actually quite similar to what they categorized as typical PD, someone not falling into one of these abnormal categories. A very exciting novel protocol was presented by Dr. Trost. He made some quote-unquote simple modifications to the IMPRESS trial with tremendous results. Some of the highlights of those are back-to-back days, a slightly different dosing protocol, injecting the patient in the erect state, and favoring the point of maximal curvature over the plaque itself. He also utilizes aggressive modeling in clinic, but does warn all of us to incorporate this practice with caution, as testicular fractures are common and almost the goal. However, with this protocol, he has increased his mean improvement by 10 degrees in the most recent group, or in the completed group by even more than that, 13.8. More importantly to me was the number of responders. So we typically expect a 60 to 70% response rate with CCH, and he was actually able to bump that up to 78% or 94%, depending on which group of patients you look at. Now, this is not to say that we have unlocked the code and we have the way to give collagenase, but rather that these modifications with an agent that we already have can produce tremendous results. So I look forward to future research. Moving on to penile prosthetics, there was several presentations regarding the use of chlorhexidine gluconate, and some of them were quite encouraging. The first study I'd like to highlight was presented by Dr. Cartman, and he dipped a Coloplast Titan into chlorhexidine gluconate the way that we would dip classically into Bactrim, and then exposed these prosthetics to the common pathogens associated with penile prosthesis infection. And after that dipping, there was a 5-log reduction in bacterial counts as compared to the controls in all pathogens except one. The only one that had a 3-log reduction was Enterococcus. It was at 2.98, and 3 is considered effective. So this is a potentially valuable agent. The other study on chlorhexidine gluconate that I wanted to highlight showed a reduction in culture positivity down to 0%. With a washout of chlorhexidine gluconate. And what they did was, at the time of explantation, in the setting of a revision, they took a small sample of the capsule and sent that for a culture. 14% of those samples were positive. They then completed the chlorhexidine gluconate washout of the space in all patients, and then sent another sample of the capsule after the washout, and the positivity rate dropped to 0. So in penile prosthetics, where prevention of infection is the name of the game, this is an exciting agent. There was a couple talks on partial component exchange or reservoir recycling. And the first one by Dr. Barham actually warns against this practice, perhaps. They associated partial component exchange with higher infectious and non-infectious complications while also producing a shorter time to revision, 168 months versus 45 months in the partial component exchange group. So proceed with caution with this technique. However, I would be remiss if I didn't say I believe there's a session right now, concurrent with this one, showing the safety and efficacy of reservoir recycling in certain patients. So this is probably more of an arena for future research rather than a statement on the practice. I was very excited as I went through the sessions to hear pelvic floor physical therapy being mentioned over and over again, but the study I wanted to highlight was by Dr. Pastor, where they had long-term data on lifelong premature ejaculation. They enrolled men for 3 times per week for 12 weeks and actually achieved a threefold increase in latency time. And even more exciting was that 67% of these men maintained ejaculatory control 72 months later. So I think it's very clear that stress urinary incontinence was just the tip of the iceberg for pelvic floor physical therapy. In other difficult to treat conditions, hard flaccid syndrome, ejaculatory pain, and painful nocturnal erections, pelvic floor physical therapy was recommended by the presenters. Add this to the new data on lifelong premature ejaculation and the already very robust data in the chronic scrotal contents pain space. I think we have a very low morbidity, effective option for many of our more difficult to treat problems in sexual medicine. Arguably, the most energy at the meeting was spent on regenerative therapies. I'll focus first on Shockwave. One study presented by Dr. Goldstein showed improvement or stability in vascular parameters, and in this case, a statistically significant decrease in end-diastolic velocity versus the sham controls. I think it's important to note that in this study, there was 2 arms with different protocols, and the fact that the results were so different, arm one showing an 89% improvement in the grayscale proximal region versus less than half of that in arm two, really speaks to our lack of knowledge of the optimal protocol. However, in the interest of this growing mountain of evidence that this may have potential therapeutic benefit, another small study showed that low-intensity shockwaves produced a durable 4-point improvement in IIEF, which is our lower limit for clinical efficacy. And I think Dr. Yaffe did an excellent job on the Sunday plenary really summarizing these regenerative therapies, and there was a couple points that we all need to take into our practice. Radial waves are consistently ineffective. So these are your acoustic waves, the products that patients can buy online. None of them ever work. There is a growing body of evidence that low intensity shockwave may produce benefit, probably in a subgroup of patients, and we'll look forward to optimizing both patient and protocol factors. However, due to the current cost, a lack of standardization of protocols, there are ethical concerns regarding charging patients for therapy at this time, and I would highly encourage anybody to visit the on-demand content for the meeting and watch those debates as they were excellent. With regard to PRP and stem cells, there were some presentations primarily showing the safety of PRP in certain conditions, but we're still waiting on efficacy data. I'll quote Dr. Yaffe and say these aren't ready for prime time right now. So I think the future is very bright for everyone, but nobody convinced me of that more effectively than Dr. Belladelli, who showed that for everyone, things are looking better and better. So I want to thank everyone for a wonderful meeting. Thank you especially to the med students and residents. It's an absolute joy to see the passion. And I hope to see you all in San Antonio.
Thank you very much. Next, for the take-home messages in pediatrics, Dr. Kate Kraft, professor, University of Michigan. Dr. Kraft.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to present on behalf of pediatrics. I have no disclosures. Over the course of the meeting, we had 6 scientific sessions comprising presentations of 96 abstracts, 2 podiums, 3 moderated poster sessions, 1 video session, 2 plenary sessions, including debates regarding pediatric kidney stone disease and vesicoureteral reflux disease, 2 named lectureships, the Meredith Campbell Lecture, the John Duckett Memorial Lecture, and we had our SPU annual meeting. So my goal this afternoon is to present to you some themes given the large volume of the great work that was discussed and presented at the annual meeting. The future of pediatric urology was a central theme for this meeting, with specific discussion surrounding longitudinal outcomes for congenital anomalies, specifically hypospadias, novel surgical techniques for the management of rare congenital conditions, innovative thinking and technology, as well as looking forward to training the next generation of our field. With respect to the future of technology, there was discussion surrounding the incorporation of high-power laser and the use of laser lithotripsy for the treatment of kidney stone disease for children, the incorporation of MOSES technology, and also the use of thulium laser, balancing better stone clearance with the potential for higher risk of thermal injury. We also had discussions surrounding harnessing the power of artificial intelligence to improve the care for our pediatric patients with regard to image analysis, predictive modeling, clinical algorithms, and understanding that machine learning and artificial intelligence are truly a team science. There was also discussion surrounding the incorporation of percutaneous tibial nerve stimulation into neuromodulation for children with overactive bladder, noting that 75 to 100% of children see immediate success with 50 to 70% of long-term improvement over time. This modality offers opportunities for patients who are drug naive or refractory to other therapies. It has been highlighted as no more painful than P10s, which is our traditional neuromodulation modality, and works in patients with larger body habitus, which unfortunately is an epidemic that we're seeing in childhood obesity nationwide. Challenges surrounding PTNS for children include inconsistent definitions and settings, and questions surrounding the role of maintenance therapy. There were also a number of presentations and discussions surrounding fetal surgery and pushing boundaries in this space, as well as contrast-enhanced ultrasound, a possible future alternative to radiographic imaging in children that limits ionizing radiation. In discussion of the future for our patients, we had discussions surrounding multidisciplinary collaboration for gender-diverse children and transgender advocacy for children, highlighting the AUA statement on transgender care, that the AUA is committed to the principle that medical decision-making for transgender children is the responsibility of parents acting in their child's best interest to ensure their physical and mental health, safety, and well-being, and that consultation with medical professionals and education via medically safe, respected, peer-reviewed resources must not be legislated or criminalized. We also had discussions surrounding the future of our workforce, looking in depth at pediatric urology fellowship training. Our workforce needs remain healthy and not dire at this point, and there seems to be equipoise in supply and demand for fellowship-trained pediatric urologists. However, we need to focus on maintaining quality in fellowship programs, as well as preparing our fellowship graduates for independent practice, as there were several studies highlighting a lack of confidence for recent graduates. Telehealth is now a mainstay in pediatric urology, the benefits of which include timely access to care, extending the reach to patients, increased convenience for families who no longer have to take time off work or school, and reduced financial impact. There was a study out of Boston Children's that noted that 3.5% of patients who were screened for use of telehealth did not have access to digital resources, and therefore we need to keep this in mind in the future. Additionally, we need to overcome barriers such as careful patient selection and ongoing evaluation, and develop an opportunity for best practices. Additionally, we understand in the post-Dobbs era that the fetal legal status is constantly evolving, and this has variable effect on prenatal counseling and intervention. So there's need for ongoing engagement and advocacy for our patients. In considering the diversity of our field, pediatric urology trainees are now reaching gender parity, but we have much work to do with respect to increased representation for those who are traditionally underrepresented in medicine, as this has been stagnant over recent years. We need to increase exposure to our field of pediatric urology to our young learners. We need to encourage students to see themselves in our profession through adequate representation, and we need to cultivate an environment that welcomes and uplifts people from a variety of backgrounds. There was also discussion surrounding research ethics, with the protection of research integrity establishment and acceptance and adherence to a set of good practice and rules, honoring the credibility of our findings and being vigilant with ourselves and our trainees. We had presentations at our Societies for Pediatric Urology meeting regarding the continuation of the SPU research grants to support early career investigators, advocacy efforts, the administration of research surveys, and new task forces centered around DEI, global surgery, and education, as well as the launch of the Encompass program to enhance wellness among pediatric urologists through small support communities. We discussed emerging conditions and techniques specifically surrounding pediatric kidney stone disease, which continues to increase and is on the rise. The Pediatric Kidney Stone Improvement Network, otherwise known as PKIDS, highlighted the need for comparative effectiveness data, as well as a consideration of a variety of different surgical approaches in treating pediatric kidney stones. At our plenary yesterday, we had a very lively debate on controversies in reflux management, and it remains that there are very diverse ideas and feelings surrounding this topic. It's obviously a very heterogeneous and dynamic disease, and patient-tailored care should be based on risk factors, not only clinical presentation, but also imaging findings. Reflux is likely only part of the risk for outcome, and we need to remember that our work is not done when reflux has resolved. We need to continue to partner with our nephrology colleagues on maintaining the health of the kidneys and for adequate follow-up. We had two named lectureships, the Meredith Campbell Lecture delivered by Mark Kane on career trajectory, and he highlighted the importance of always remembering to teach, innovate, operate, and help others while integrating with one's other life interests. Dr. Jonathan Ruth delivered the John Duckett Memorial Lecture, Innovation by Necessity, Improving Urodynamics for Children with Spina Bifida, and highlighted that urodynamics continues to have great promise in its ability to characterize the bladder and reduce cognitive bias, although it also has great shortcomings, and we must do better for our patients. It's thought that machine learning may have potential to improve interpretation of urodynamics, although it's not quite ready for prime time, but stay tuned. So in summary, the future of pediatric urology is very bright with regard to our strong missions in patient care, advocacy and policy, education, research, and quality improvement and patient safety. Again, I thank you for the opportunity to provide a summary of our pediatrics meeting here at the AUA 2023.
Thank you, Dr. Kraft. Our next speaker will present take-home messages on global health and humanitarian issues. This will be presented by Dr. Rajiv Singhal, Associate Professor, University of Toronto.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you to Dr. Denstedt and the AUA Scientific Committee to provide a little bit of a platform to talk about this increasingly important topic on global health and humanitarianism. These are my disclosures, none that are relevant to this talk. So basically, this is, again, reflecting a growing interest in global health here at the AUA. There was one primary scientific session where 14 abstracts were presented in a moderated poster session yesterday morning. And I just like to summarize the broad themes of that. And so basically, as we went around and looked at these presentations, there were a few that addressed health inequity and barriers to care, and it was interesting there was some that were domestic and some that were global, and there's some commonality there. There were some that reported on existing programs and proposed build-outs, the role for technology in addressing global health patient access challenges. There were a couple of cost analysis studies and some general surveys that would then inform further needs assessments. So that were some of the broad themes. And so we'll start with this. There were, this was a couple of related studies, related posters from the Ohio State Group that basically looked at it two ways. You know, this is a university program. They looked at their clinics and who was accessing their clinics at the university campus, and then worked with a community not-for-profit partner that was in Columbus who was building out primary care, and they provided the ability to provide monthly visits with us, with an attending and some residents to a community clinic in the Columbus area. And it was interesting, they looked at it both from the patient perspective and from the resident perspective with pre and post questionnaires and surveys. And the resident one was, they were both, the patient barriers were not surprising. There was a lot of self-reflection on the part of the residents in terms of, did their skills improve around managing other communities, their knowledge around some cultural challenges, and just their attitudes and perceived biases on how they deliver care. And in all of those domains, there was significant improvement and an interest to grow on that. And similarly, and not surprisingly, there were significant barriers as patients saw things, both the orange is the community clinic relative to the Ohio State University clinic. And it primarily went down on lines around language barriers, educational achievement, and financial concerns. There was the study out of Phoenix at Maricopa County that Dr. Khan presented. There are 90,000 refugees that have been settled in Arizona as part of the larger program. They come from all over the world. And this was just to get a sense of, are these needs, these healthcare needs, being met? And again, another domestic study that looked at word of mouth. They use word of mouth and outreach into these refugee communities. These are a group of people that don't necessarily want to give a lot of information. And so they looked at a small group, 58 women, almost 70% were from sub-Saharan Africa, and it was really a self-reported questionnaire on urinary incontinence, defined as one reported episode at least in a month. And there was a significant increase relative to what you would expect in terms of incontinence in this group of women. And the real important piece was that 83% of them never addressed it or discussed it with their healthcare provider. And similarly, almost the same number were actually never asked by the healthcare provider. And so this was really seen as an opportunity, again, to reflect on unique challenges in different communities and provide some training to ask and maybe screen for some of the, in this case, incontinence in this particular community. And so it was seen as an opportunity to, again, work on the healthcare provider side. And then also, again, another domestic study. Right, Rochester Cancer Center, big nationally recognized center. There was a realization that right within that urban environment, many patients are not getting the care that they need. And so they worked with a Catholic charity organization that was working in a primary care clinic and set up essentially bi-monthly visits of 4 to 6 patients with suspected cancers primarily, where both the staff and residents would go. And there were 12 sessions, and they reported on 12 sessions. And again, the themes are similar, right? Despite having a cancer center that's right in Rochester, individuals struggle to obtain basic care, and the barriers are the same, right? There are barriers due to cost and insurance. Hematuria workups were particularly thought to be challenging because they need further investigations. And so, again, 4 domestic studies that really are applied close to home and some of the challenges that we see overseas. One that addressed things on the global perspective, again, access to surgical care is so difficult in most of the developing world. And so is there a way maybe to take problems that might require a solution surgically and work on improving conservative therapy? So this was a study by the group in Charlottesville that looked at female incontinence in Belize. Very small study, but important. They had a 7-day visit. They identified 10 patients and educated them on pelvic floor physiotherapy and pelvic floor education. And then they coached them, and then they gave daily questionnaires for 6 months, and then they reviewed things. And what they demonstrated was, first of all, quite simply, they were able to get a very good and demonstrate a good understanding of these techniques, and then they actually noted improvement in all domains. And so the next step would be to recruit and hopefully local people to help identify community partners in an attempt to scale things. The next broad theme then was really reporting on existing programs and build-outs. And so there were 3 main ones. This was a group that's been going, a well-established group that's been going from from Ann Arbor and from Chicago that have been going to Rwanda to a big urban hospital in Kigali. They've been doing 3 trips a year. And there was a sense as they've gone and fixed fistulas and repaired fistulas that the overall numbers were probably similar, but there was a sense that maybe there was an increase in the incidence of upper urinary tract fistulas from the cervix on higher, and they wanted to look at that. So they looked at their experience from 2013, and that number basically went from about 16% that were upper urinary tract fistulas to about just under 50%. It was thought maybe to be to an increase in C-sections. There seemed to be a sense that there was a practice change and they were being offered more C-sections in this hospital. It wasn't clear how many of these C-sections followed a prolonged labor. And so again, this was thought then as a next step, these missions will continue to streamline obstetrics protocols in this hospital and identify opportunities to improve training in local C-section performance. As we all know, and I'd encourage everyone who hasn't had the chance to look at the Lancet Commission on Global Surgery in 2015. They identified 3 bellwether procedures that are particularly important in global surgery before you do anything else: C-sections, laparotomy, and fixing broken bones. And so clearly there's an opportunity, if there's a skills improvement in that environment, to improve C-sections. Extra fee, complicated problem. This is Dr. Schaefer from Utah. $40 million people in Uganda, 20 million people who are children, basically. There are 6 pediatric surgeons in the country, one of whom is a pediatric urologist. And so basically American Bladder Extrophy Expertise partnered with the Association of Bladder Extrophy Community, which is a large advocacy group that that promotes and funds and supports internationally the work to care and help these people, these patients. And so they did a planning trip in 2018, and they planned for 5 annual visits to work with a well-identified same care team. There was some challenges in 2019. They performed 18 procedures and then identified a number of challenges, not least of which was 2 years that were lost to the pandemic and then a local outbreak in 2022. A clear understanding that there's a complex problem. Identifying an ideal urinary diversion was still unclear. It was identified that orthopedic pediatric expertise should be ideally needed. And then really most importantly, identifying and building out local teams to support and follow, particularly social work support. And then a lot of the supply funding challenges were identified and the need to continue to work for not-for-profits. This group from New York visited go to Ecuador, mid-sized hospital in Ecuador that had been going primarily plastics and general surgery. And in the 2022 visit, a urology resident came along on this. This is entirely funded through New York, through the hospital. They take all of their equipment there and basically identify cases and triage them and work for the week. And what they realized, there was a number of high-impact, low-risk procedures in urology that they were not servicing and leaving behind. Circumcisions, orchidopexies, hydroceles, and inguinal hernia repairs, and the hope was to target that on a subsequent visit. Role of technology in addressing global health challenges. A group out of India, you know, we actually have that problem here around patients sometimes not coming back for getting their stents out, looking at a web-based WhatsApp-assisted model to interface with an Excel sheet that had patient data in it and essentially sending messages based on the time of the appointment to see if this would bring people in. WhatsApp is ubiquitous in India and in a lot of the developing in a lot of other parts of the world. That's been my experience in Africa as well. And so they commented on a positive trend in appointment and attendance that was noted. This was voted the best poster for the session using augmented reality. Dr. McCammon from Virginia, a seasoned reconstructive surgeon, has had established trips in 3 of these 4 countries. The pandemic created a need to mentor differently. They used a couple of different AR devices to see if they could work alongside, provide some pointers as they were doing the case in real time. The results were equivocal. Interestingly, he said he had met with three of the four, and they were the ones that found it so-so in terms of helpfulness because they'd already had him and had that relationship, and the one person who he'd only met virtually. So it was thought to be of some value, but not a replacement for on-site mentorship, but certainly maybe have a role to play to augment that. A cost analysis study. We know that the World Health Organization has identified that early circumcision can reduce HIV transmission. The Shangri-La clamp compared to a conventional clamp, they just looked at three countries, Tanzania, Kenya, and Uganda, and essentially said the costs are similar, and so that would be good. It's a safe, and they were looking at it from a cost effectiveness and a safety perspective. A lot of patients, and the thought was with further scalability, we may be able to reduce those costs further and help address that, a very important public health initiative. This was a study in Guyana where they do open kidney stone surgery, retrospective 5 years, 51 identifiable pyelothotomy cases that could potentially be PCNL cases. There was a debate, should we bring this equipment in and start doing perks? They looked at real costs of doing those cases and theoretical costs of what a PCNL might look like. $862 savings, primarily based on length of stay. Again, these were theoretical costs. Capital costs and maintenance of the equipment were not factored in. And then just a couple of general surveys to close out. The group in Kilimanjaro, there is actually an established neurology program there. They've had a new lodging center to house up to 500 patients and families, and a soon to open radiation center. And so just getting ready for what that would look like was a survey of what they're doing. There's a ton of prostate cancers. Interestingly, it was a single cutoff, a very old traditional cutoff of 4 to trigger biopsies for prostate cancer, and most of them were found to be Gleason 7 disease. And finally, looking at a group that are presumably genetically similar, Chinese Americans versus mainland Chinese, two large databases, significant increase in prostate cancer and testis cancer incidence in Chinese Americans compared to mainland Chinese. Whether these are cultural, environmental factors, potentially advocacy and access to care factors here in America, it wasn't clear. Further work to do on that.
Okay, and if so, you could wrap up, please.
That's it, and I just would thank everybody for inviting me and for taking the time today.
We hope you enjoyed this episode and look forward to seeing you at AUA 2024 in San Antonio.